Tonight, we are fortunate to have Rhea Anastas with us to present Being Opposite, in which she is sharing the projects of the acclaimed Orchard Gallery from her informed and actually personal perspective as a founder of this 12-person artist-run cooperative gallery, which ran 2005 to 2008 on New York's Lower East Side. And just a note, I learned this evening as we were previewing things that there's a part two, but it's a surprise. So I'll just go forward with talking about Orchard because, and I'm very excited about that. Orchard, for those of you that don't know, is a project which became the embodiment of a certain strain of critical artistic discourse. It has been a source of Rhea's writing and research along with other areas of scholarship and curatorial practice. Rhea Anastas is an art historian, a critic, a curator, and associate professor at UC Irvine in the art department. With a BA and an MA from Columbia and a PhD from the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, she is recognized for her contribution to the discourse of contemporary art. In 2011 to 2012, she was the Otis Visiting Fine Arts Critic in Residence Fellow for Otis College of Art and Design in Los Angeles. And in addition to her curatorial work at Orchard, Rhea organized New Cuts K8, as in K and the number 8, Hardy, an exhibition of a performance documented in video by K8 Hardy, who happens to be from Fort Worth. For some of you may be familiar with Katie Hardy from here and from her reputation as an artist. There is also her recent project with Chicago-based filmmaker Colleen Smith that opened in January. Colleen Smith, whose work is currently in the Whitney Biennial, which just opened. And some of you may recall, Colleen gave a Tuesday evening's presentation a few years ago. Yeah. I have a real soft spot for Colleen. She's an amazing artist, so I'm anxious to hear more about that. Books by Rhea include Dan Graham, works 1965 to 2000, co-edited by Marianne Brower, and Witness to Her Art, Art and Writings by Adrian Piper, Mona Hatoum, Katie Nolan, Jenny Holzer, Kara Walker, Danielle Russell, and Audu Cologne, co-edited by Michael Brinson. Rhea's most recent publication, Double Bind, is a dialogue co-written with the artist Leela Dare. And I can highly recommend that. It's a very interesting book of writing. And finally, Rhea is editor of a forthcoming book that captures the artist's voice in dialogues, essays, scripts, statements, and letters by Orchard's co-founders and the wider community who co-created the exhibitions and public discourse of the gallery. Which brings us to our being here tonight. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Rhea Anastas.
Hi, it's very nice to be here tonight. Thank you so much for that generous introduction. This is such good work that you do, this Tuesday evening series at the Modern. You're so lucky to have something like this in your community, in your city, Fort Worth. So it's really fantastic. Thanks also to Michael Moore and John Knuckles for their work making tonight's talk happen. I live in Los Angeles now. I have for over 8 years. I actually don't speak about Orchard very often, and I very much like to do so. But I'm doing it again because I'm editing this book project. And although, as you can see, because I have a part two about another artist, I don't like to dwell on the past. But we will be spending the first half thinking about this project from, 10 years ago, 2005 to 2008, on New York's Lower East Side, even though I'm a Los Angelino now, so we'll be looking at New York for the first part of the talk. Okay, I guess I'm ready. Oh, here's my title slide. So it's being the opposite, which is how I think about Orchard, some things that artists do, and how I think about what criticism does. Orchard was a provisional gallery in New York's Lower East Side, a then-transitional neighborhood in downtown Manhattan. Orchard was started in May 2005 in the grim after-hours of George W. Bush's re-election. It was founded by 9 artists: Moira Davey, Andrea Fraser, Nicholas Guanini, Gareth James, Christian Philip Muller, Jeff Price, R.H. Quaitman, Karen Schneider, and Jason Simon, together with a systems analyst, John Yancey Jr., an anonymous member, and myself. The gallery was also started in the shadow cast by the death of artist Colin DeLand, whose gallery had had a singular vision and felt more like a criticism room than a showroom. With a predetermined lifespan of 3 years, Orchard opted to be a commercial for-profit business rather than a nonprofit alternative space, although it was an alternative, but we decided not to locate ourselves economically as a nonprofit. The gallery was active between May 2005 and May 2008. Then, as now, I refuse to let go of the idea that to embark on even the most common encounter with art, say to experience a single artwork or video or experimental film, or to see a group show in a gallery, is to think freely about social life, ideally to talk freely, and to summon a human predisposition for speech, for disagreement, and otherness that is part of aesthetic experience. This incitement to thought and debate, often entailing some confusion and a sense of displacement, is what I mean by the title of this talk, Being the Opposite. Orchard hoped to make plain the social purpose of art for artists and others within an artist's tradition. Once the gallery opened, threads of connection emerged between Orchard and other artists. Others, too, desired a gallery that was more informal and more open, a space for argument as much as art. The artists of Orchard, in engagement with this wider community, co-created the exhibitions and public events of the gallery. Jason Simon had a perfect description of Orchard, quote, an idea-driven social space. End quote. A portion of this talk offers glimpses into Orchard's archives, yet my emphasis is very decisively not on a history of the gallery, not on its projects, exhibitions, not a survey, not looking at those things overall. My first sections begin mostly with film and video material, only a couple of slides. First a film excerpt and then a performance video. In the talk's second section, I share a piece of very recent writing as a way of extending the ideas of the Orchard Project into the present in the writing that I'm doing now. At the outset, let me suggest 2 ideas for listening to this talk that have to do with why praxis, the how of doing, gets so much attention here. Idea 1, let the artworks and writings of this lecture affect you. Watch how they operate and watch or listen to yourself watching. Do this before that need kicks in, which we all have, which is assumed to be progressive, that need to be critical. As I prepared this talk, I read the following passage from Jackson Maclow's postscript to Simone Forti's book of writing called O Tongue, absorbing the influence of this passage. Quote, there's all too much liking and disliking of artworks, too many people telling others how they feel and what other people should feel about them, and far too little receptive looking and listening. Be open to them. Don't fill your heads with other people's feelings and thoughts about them. Don't jump to evaluations. Let a work of art be in you for a while before you let the goods and bads take over. Let experience happen. opinion isn't all that important. The being of a work and your experience of it are. Well said. Thank you, Maclow. Idea two. Think of this talk as me trying to comprehend my own participation in Orchard in terms other than historicization for the most part, without the usual distance that analytical models assume. Orchard's way of working, what you or I may learn from Orchard's methods and retool to use now, under very changed conditions of today, this is how I would like to define the gallery's legacy. As a practice with a plurality of extensions, what I have written to read here today is not an external reflection. It is not history with a capital H. Okay, so we're going to look at a couple of minutes of Jeff Price's film Stop from 2012, but the footage in this film dates from 1995. Here's the first work. It's about 2.5 minutes of it, and I'll let you watch and experience first before I speak about it.
You love. They mock you.
Oh, look at that.
Allows you to give such coherence to your claim.
Now this, you know what counts for me? Inward value, an emotional value.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean...
And it's one of the ugliest I fit you don't like.
Every day, once or twice, and I look at this. I don't claim to be competent.
Blind state of you for.
I don't need to come here for culture.
What does all this have to do with my experience?
And this is a beautiful.
So that it's the stuff inside, but in the foyer, the dining room, the living room. Shoes, the sofa, the dining. And that's me. I don't know, you know. Simple as that. And then you.
Beautiful piece. You really buy with your soul.
Now imagine tattooed on the shoulder, just like that. Imagine the.
You just saw a 2.5 minute long excerpt from Jeff Price's feature-length film Stop, 2012, assembled from 354 lab film rolls deployed in chronological order. Those are the numbers that you saw. Recall that Price was one of Orchard's co-founders. Stop documents the first scenes of Orchard's founding and opening, placing the gallery's earliest days among other events of contemporary social life, New York City after 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, incidents from family life, friendships, work, and travel. At the film's center is Price's son's journey of gender self-determination, an extreme porousness, queered and radical between the sanctioned realms of the so-called private and public is what projects like Orchard, this film, and experimental art in general, and feminist or queer gender self-determination all share. Stop serves me as a model for my own writing on Orchard. What you just saw, the last part of it with all the smoke. One night during June 2005, Karen Schneider and Jutta Kutter are performing Sabotage, an atmospheric sound work, to close Orchard's opening daytime exhibitions, part one and part two. The artist's use of a smoke machine brand name The Eliminator was straightforward enough. Or was it? I can't recall if it was the noise of Kutter's keyboard amp or the artificial smoke itself that led to the sudden appearance of New York City firefighters outside Orchard. Their presence seemed to open an abyss of 9/11 memories. The jumpers and the sirens and the smoke. Granted, the Eliminator's outpouring was faint compared to those days on end of smoke and ash, but our posture said everything. The room emptied quietly. We were dutiful. Apparently, a neighbor had called the fire department, itself a sign of post-9/11 psychology and sloganeering. If you see something, say something. Sabotage had sabotaged itself, driving home the way in which the news and distrust and fear were unavoidable undercurrents in those years. Quote, Orchard should be a place for experimentation, not dogmas. End quote. This is how Karen Schneider once articulated her sense of the freedoms this gallery could germinate. Produced from a place of self-implication and candor with very few devices, I now see Orchard's work as piercing through neoliberalism and art critique as enclosing systems of image and value and debt. In the sense of Eve Kozofsky Sedgwick's writing on affect, Orchard was and is everyday theory, theory not academically conceived. In the spirit of STOP, I would like to think my current scholarship on Orchard's past as essentially not one thing and certainly not a formulation written at a distance or from the outside. My project is to edit a book of writings by Orchard's artists and collaborators. The book has two related publications. We made a print, we remade an artwork from R.H. Quaitman from that time, and we're selling the print to support the fundraising for the book. And the resurrection of Orchard's original website has been made possible by an artist-run organization in Portland, Oregon, called Yale Union. And they have done all the web work and programming to make our website available. So since what you are hearing tonight is essentially not an external view, I have to try to define my work as other than art history or criticism or interpretation, at least as these are usually understood. I'm using this talk as a way to try to define what it is that I'm doing. The artwork you will see is culled from the archives of Artists in Orchard, which I consider my primary research, my material. Where I believe my techniques depart from most of the usual business of scholarship is the way I write my own presence and self-implication in the history that I am narrating. I want a criticism that can be honest about self-implication, that uses intimacy and the experiential as part of its basic materials, as its material ideas. Artist Andrea Fraser and I frequently use the term euphemism as a byword for more normative art criticism, reminding ourselves what not to do, what not to suppress. How to write without euphemism in its many forms and many ways of not talking about that much, that which should be unsettled and that which should be probed. How to write without donning the cloak and frail shelter of specialist frameworks and languages. Let's look at this performance by Fraser. It's what we opened the space with, and the performance was live, and a group show was organized by Fraser and Quaitman and myself in relationship to it. And for about 13 minutes, you'll see Fraser run through her monologue once with everything that's happening in the gallery.
It's a beautiful show, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And this is a beautiful piece. I would say that this work is the apotheosis of abstraction. It's an abstraction that implies an absolute simplification and reduction within a language of well-balanced purity, has extraordinary colors and formal intensity. The first time I saw it, I fell in love with it. It's distinctive, disinterested, gratuitous, refined, restrained, sober, calm, guileless, good, simple, certain. It's perfect. It has such tact, such grace, such quiet self-assurance. It's so far away from the passions that ordinary people invest in their ordinary lives. This is art. This is culture.
belongs to a more polite society, a more polished, better place world of bearing and harmony, the total beautiful environment of an ultimate life of appreciation on the highest level of response. It's the expression of a truly developed taste, the taste that allows you to give such coherence to your collection. Now this, I think, is a beautiful piece. You know what counts for me, first of all, is the beauty of the thing. The value isn't what counts. It's the pleasure that it gives you. My favorite clients have always been the ones who collect out of love, just as children collect postage stamps. You fall in love with a thing that pleases you and you can't resist it. I always prefer pleasure. Pleasant things are non-necessary things. That's our inheritance. Freedom from the lower, coarse, vulgar, servile, material demands of the social world. Look, it's the illusion that it hasn't been made, that none of this was paid for and nothing will be bought. It hangs there as if it just spread itself out before us voluntarily, of its own volition. It's always been there and will always be there for us. The only work you do is wanting. I want it and I have it. It's as simple as that. And then you produce its value, an inward value, an emotional value. When you've wanted it, you've looked for it, and at last you found it. And you would do anything to have it. You want it more than your mother's love, more than money. You have to buy with your eyes, not your ears. You really buy with your soul. I always tell my clients that the criterion for buying an artwork should be whether you want to have it in your home. Loving something means having it with you. Your collection expresses the texture and quality and even the smell of your life. It signifies everything about you, from the condition of your teeth to the way that you love. You're branded by the objects you love. They mark you as the property of your culture, the property of your class. Now imagine this picture tattooed on my shoulder. It's like that. Imagine the clothes that I'm wearing and the rest of my environment have been painted on my skin, and then the whole thing is turned inside out so that it's the stuff inside. The shoes, the sofa, the dining room. You know, these are the things for which you'll be remembered. These are the things for which you'll be loved. It's always with you. It's inside. And it's outside at the same time for everyone to see. It's a prison. Oh, look at that. Certain times of day, the way the light floods in through these windows. It's stunning. It's a wonderful space. I was born into a world of art. My mother was an extremely cultured and sensitive woman. All her life she was an attractive, simple worshipper of what everyone knows is the best. The best society, the best individuals, the best standards of living with all its appurtenances. When I go to a museum, like the Metropolitan, I feel right at home. That's how my mother hung her collection. But in the foyer, the dining room, the living room, the bedrooms, the guest rooms, and the halls, and the bathroom, she had one of these in the bath. It's a wonderful house. Quiet, calm, cool, like fresh linen laid in wicker trays. There's something beautiful in every corner, flowers and the freshest smell. That's my grandmother there. She was beautiful. And that's me. You know, some people come in here and they want to invest, and then they haven't got the time. Imagine, they haven't got the time to be personally interested. On the one hand, investment. On the other, total incompetence. If you stuck a piece of shit on the wall, it'd be all the same to them as long as someone told them the shit was worth money. That's the Wall Street approach. Hedge funds. And I detest collectibles. Oh, I bought little knickknacks and trinkets that I've distributed to all and sundry. But I'd never clutter myself up. May we have some quiet in here, please? I think there was a mob of people in here pushing. I hate crowds filling the air with their breathing and their noise. For example, suburban secretaries who fill their homes with posters, prints, and Martha Stewart projects. Mother used to say it's outrageous. Making things like that ought to be banned. Horrible, horrible habits. They don't even know how to eat, those people. Heavy, thick, bloated, and fat with hunger on cheap foods. I mean, I suppose I spoke up for everyone's right to have their own taste. I mean, why not? At least they have a taste. I mean, I think it's charming. It's so simple and fervent, so direct, so real. Sturdy, happy, uncomplicated. Leave it unspoiled and just enjoy it. That's what I always say. My mother, you know, is just an attractive, simple worshiper of what everyone knows is the best. She wasted her life on linen and flowers. It was an empty, empty, airless, dusty, meaningless life. Suffocating, sumptuous, and boring. Heirlooms. Don't make me laugh. I mean, I just can't bear the gentility of some galleries and museums. And there's so much work around now I find completely grim. I can't be bothered with it. I mean, I think it's complete tripe. And I hate people who are producing neat, tidy work. I just don't like eggs. Now, this is an artist who's doing exactly what she wants. I mean, it's a breath of fresh air. You know, I asked her once what attracted her to this subject, and she said, it just interests me. It's what I want to do. I mean, she has the capacity to surprise me on a regular basis. Sometimes she comes in here and I offer her coffee, and I get the feeling that maybe the cup isn't clean enough for her. And then the next thing I hear, she's off in Africa somewhere, rolling in the mud. Have you been to Africa? Now, this is a piece that I find wildly exciting, a tremendous wallop. What a thrill. I mean, she's the real thing. She's still out there. She's really out there. And she puts everything into her work. I mean, it's the shirt on her back. It's her neighborhood bar. It's the songs her mother sang to when she was a child. It's the man she loves. It's her life. And it's not expensive. Not expensive. It's incredible. I mean, it's a woman in a bikini at a cocktail party. It's so outrageous. Everyone thinks it's outrageous. Except me, of course. I mean, I think it's funny. And it's sexy. And it's one of the ugliest mirrors of paint I have ever seen. I mean, it's the top. It's a Waldorf salad. What do you think? You know, I think I must have been born with a love of the unfamiliar. It's something you can't be taught. And I'm happiest with works of my time. They reflect me. But my favorite clients have always been the ones who try to be out on the edge. You know, even if they have unlimited resources, and most of them don't. It's better to be buying artists who search out new directions, to be in the forefront with them. By the time it gets to the museums and auctions, it's safe. There's no discovery. You know, where I grew up, there was no art. I mean, there were a few family things. You know, there were pictures passed on. There was no culture. I'm the first in my family to go to college. Almost. I mean, this wouldn't mean a thing to them, except that I'm a success. That just shows you how narrow their lives are. I mean, I've always wanted art to question what I know already, to open me up as a human being so that my life was more deeply significant. Now, this is a piece that I find extremely challenging, okay? I mean, this is the kind of thing that no one without our precise history and educational background could possibly fathom. Can you believe there are still people out there asking that tired old question, is it art, right? I mean, this is about process, okay? This is about procedure. It's too easy to say, it's in a gallery. I mean, she's really an intellectual. Self-possessed, reflexive, and in this piece, she's forcing the viewer to be reflexive, too. It's very risky work. It's critical. I mean, that's the kind of work she dares to do. She's never made a safe decision in her life, doesn't know how to. That's terrific. You know, for a long time, she didn't even make anything to sell. So far away from the rational, quantitative world of business and finance. But just like in business, you have to take risks if you want an edge. Art keeps your mind limber. I always prefer risk. Creating, inventing, investing in visions of change and opportunity. You know, I was having lunch with Glenn Lauer the other day at the Modern. And Glenn said to me, he said, Andrea, there's just no place for you on our board. Go back to the Now Museum. I mean, imagine, that's what I want. I don't like pretentious people. I mean, people who don't know how to behave, you know, because you're not up to their level. These Ivy League graduates and cultural establishment elites flaunting their money and education, flouting our values with so-called works of art. They're taunting us, you know, they're taunting the American people. It's outrageous. Making things like this ought to be banned. I mean, this is what contemporary art has sunk to. This level, this indignity, this outrage. I mean, this is a disgrace. This isn't art. It's a perversion of art. This isn't culture. Now, this is a picture I like. It's pretty, isn't it? It's nice. It's cheerful. I stop every day once or twice and I look at this. Somehow I feel better. Don't ask me why. I mean, I'll be tired and I'll be sitting in a chair with my head down nearly to the floor, and I look up. I don't claim to be competent. I like art, but I don't know very many artists' names. I mean, I'd like to, but I haven't got the time. It's always the same, you know, you have to have the time. I mean, I've got a lot of trinkets and odds and ends, you know, I found in aunts and uncles' attics. They were terribly tarnished and rusty, but I cleaned them up. All those things, they're worth a bit now. They're cleaned up. In this place, no museum.
But the vases aren't dust traps either. I mean, that vase now. I needed a vase for flowers, so when they asked me what I wanted, I said a vase. And they got it, because I know how to make good use out of it. They know not to buy me things I won't use. I don't have money to throw away. I don't agree when they say get something you like. You often have to do things in life that you don't like to start with, but then you just have to like them. My mother liked to keep things clean. My mother would dust and help cook. It wasn't her job to cook. There was another woman whose job it was to cook. She would come home and describe their house. A lot of pictures, fresh linen, flowers. She passed away, my mother. Slow death in a terrible small room. I went to museums to see what it would be like to live in a big, clean, quiet house. I learned just from looking. I always wanted to be a beautiful person. I don't know. You know, maybe it's a fine piece of art, but it's not for me. I wouldn't know what to do with that. You know, this is the kind of thing that only means something to a particular type of person. Don't think that I don't understand it. I understand it. I understand that it was produced to mystify me, you know, that it was produced to exclude me. You know, if you're not one of those people who affects history, and most of us aren't, how are you supposed to enjoy looking for personal meaning in the souvenirs of that class of people who manipulate history to your exclusion? I think it takes a pretty blind state of euphoric identification to enjoy somebody's power to exclude you. I mean, when I go to galleries, I usually end up feeling angry and powerless. I find myself thinking, who are these people, you know? I mean, where did they get their money? What does all this have to do with my experience? I don't need to come here to be told I don't belong here. I don't need to come here for culture. Culture is ordinary. Culture is common.
Before addressing what you just saw, we're going to take a quick detour. I'll share you one more thing from the archive. I want to share a few of the ideas that animated the gallery and to surround Fraser's live piece with a mindfulness of the gallery's social and economic experiments. What you're looking at is a piece of writing by Fraser, a questionnaire for Orchard members. It's a page long. I'll read a good part of it. Dear Art Sales and Services Working Title Group, at our last meeting of partial attendance, we decided to ask all the members of our little group to answer the following questions. We hope that this brief questionnaire will further the development of our project. Of course, no one will be held to their answers to these questions. The point is just to get the ideas on paper and circulating. 1. Please list your favorite ideas for the name of the gallery project in order of preference. 2. Please describe your interest in and goals for the project, be they artistic, political, practical, material, intellectual, professional, social, etc., etc., etc. Be as brief or as long-winded, general or specific as you like. 3. Please describe what you would like to do in or with the project, both in terms of the role you would like to play in the day-to-day structure of the gallery and specific projects, events, or programs you would like to undertake. One idea of how to approach the structuring of the project as a whole, as well as the group, is to start with every participant's individual projects and make sure that the project group is structured so as to accommodate all of these goals. 4. Another idea that arose in the last meeting is that one of the things that could be very worthwhile to demonstrate with our gallery is that artistic histories and genealogies matter, that the value of our work as artists, writers, and curators is not just determined by the market, but by artistic and intellectual traditions and projects that we hope to further. Skipping down to 7 and 8. 7, also in the interest of developing an economic base for the project, please list any individuals, foundations, or organizations that you believe could be approached for grants or financial contributions. 8, would you or would you not be able to make a financial contribution towards the gallery's operating budget? To share a few more specifics of the financial model being developed in this questionnaire, the gallery's 12 partners founded a for-profit limited liability corporation for the project, organized Orchard according to cost and work-sharing methods borrowed from familiar cooperative group structures. The principal and largest expense we took on was signing a 3-year lease agreement for the gallery's storefront space at 47 Orchard Street. You may already discern in this financial engagement some potential for trouble, or at least some necessary questions. One question is how to weigh the market by taking part in it. The gallery was undertaken with a tone of realism and a fiery intention to critique the economic relations and conditions of the art market, to support art and intellectual traditions that weren't being financially backed. One way to critique the gallery system is simply by starting one of your own. Orchard's members were implicated at all times as the gallery showed and sold the work of its own artists, as if to say that caring for oneself is not self-indulgence, but self-preservation and an act of political conflict. Sales were infrequent. Orchard's status as a commercial gallery was not a farce, but outright financial success was never our goal. Our goal was to seriously weigh the market, to learn more about it by taking part in it, and hopefully to demystify it in the process. The fact that Orchard was in the business of making a public program and selling art does not mean it slipped into the market with ease or passively accepted anything that we found there. The gallery was a kind of audit, a test. Orchard's artists negotiated conflicting positions, those of dealer, artist, secretary, historical participant, adjusting art history from an artist's perspective. I should say, too, this project was never just about ideas. It was never just a debate at the level of ideas. It's a problem that, when you get down to it, so much of what we call critique is that. The realism or pragmatism with which Orchard was undertaken reached all the way through to the artworks, to their usually suppressed economic and social conditions. That's a lot of what Fraser's monologue is about. It's all from existing sources. She didn't write one word of it, from interviews with dealers, from things that artists have said, from the writing of French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu and other sources. The test for everything we were doing lay in this, in the claims of artistic positions on the level of social and economic conditions, and in the works themselves. Because you have now seen it, let's let Fraser's May I Help You, it's the name of the performance, be the artwork for testing what that artistic position holds. Fraser initially developed this performance in 1991, first performed it at Colin DeLand's Gallery, American Fine Arts in New York, with an installation of 100 of Alan McCollum's plaster surrogates that McCollum had specially made for Fraser's show, live work. 3 actors, 2 female and 1 male, delivered Fraser's 15-minute monologue to gallery visitors throughout that exhibition. For the piece's restaging at Orchard, Fraser revisited her monologue, same script with some updates, and it reflects, you know, social differences and different degrees of feelings of inclusion and exclusion from the cultural field and art and the art experience. Fraser herself performed the piece in the Orchard work. She voiced and acted out all 6 characters. She performed May I Help You more intensely than she had in the past, offering some 5 or 6 performances per day over 7 days as part of an intergenerational group show that included Orchard members and other artists. So as a co-founder and co-owner of the gallery and as an artist who is already recognizable as the work's author, Fraser had been putting her work in public since the mid-80s, she necessarily enacted additional roles beyond that of the script. Restaging May I Help You clarified this piece as a work of live performance at a time when Fraser was very strongly reinvesting in live performance in her work. Watching this document now, I can see how caught up Fraser's performance was in Orchard's social dynamics. Quote, Orchard is located in the historic Lower East Side, Quaitman once wrote. Our gallery used to be a lingerie store and functioned as a minion for the Jewish salesmen in the area. Quaitman added, the gallery itself is a very modest space run on a very small budget, end quote. Fraser wore a new costume, by which she meant to evoke the attire of a New York gallerist, circa the late 80s or early 90s, the sleeveless cocktail dress above the knee, the slingback heels. The show's organizers, Quaitman, Fraser, and myself, selected a very small group of McCollum's works, the same series that were in the original piece, but in this case only five, and dispersed them with special permission from McCollum throughout the show's other works. These decisions point to the collaborative nature of Orchard's approach in general, and the combining kept going in and around the show May I Help You could be experienced in two forms, Fraser's live performance and as a film and performance document, the form of the work you just saw, in which Fraser collaborated with filmmaker Jeff Price, the filmmaker of Stop that you saw first. For this film, Orchard Document, May I Help You, Price combined footage from six of Fraser's live performances and mixed this 16mm Bolex footage with other 16mm footage from a day of filming with Fraser plus an audience who was cast to be filmed as Fraser performed. Price heightened the filmic by keying this 16mm film to Fraser's voice and words following the soundtrack of one of Fraser's run-throughs to edit, slash, unite a multitude of film clips as if sound were a separable force in this performance as some kind of raw material. I want Fraser's intense endurance to help me talk about the physical and daily operations of the gallery. Some lines by the dancer Simone Forti conjure the kind of physicality I mean. Forti describes a vibrational loop between thought and sensation, writing that, quote, a new thought can suddenly change my posture when I am open to my impulses. A thought can downright throw me to the ground. It can set me running out or microplaying a heavy fullness through my arm. New sensations lead to new thoughts, end quote. Forti's account of sensation speaks to Orchard's kinesthetic dimension, throws light on the gallery as an experiment in technique. I think of the sensation of walking down that block of Orchard Street, of arriving at the storefront to open the gallery, operating this metal rolling gate over the entrance. It required an awkward dance with a hook and a worn-out lock mechanism. I still have a small chip on the lower edge of one of my front teeth from a time when the gate came crashing down on me because I hadn't steadied it attentively enough as it was lowering. How did Fraser feel while performing May I Help You? Walking and talking down Orchard's narrow length during our first show, had she ever worked like this within gallery walls she herself sheetrocked and built, upon which she had hung works by artists like Al McCollum and Louise Lawler, people who figured in her life and work as friends and mentors and peers? Work always has this felt and personal dimension, and yet, once made public, shows tend to strip this away. They tend to conceal the personal and the private parts of how we feel about things and what they mean to us from view. I can see it more clearly now. When the towers fell, Forti has written, I changed my focus, and I'm not the only one, end quote. Orchard was started at a time when everything had to be seen in a different light, in a way that parallels feminist group analyses of the 1970s and 80s. Orchard was a change we made within ourselves, within our everyday lives. Quote, one can only transform relationships in their enactment, end quote, Fraser observes. Quote, the tricky part of this is that also means in one's own participation in this enactment, end quote. One thing this means to me is that Orchard was itself an artwork we put ourselves into. Another way I think about Orchard is how Greg Bordowitz relates his ideas in the dialogue, Artist is a Currency, quote, I know as an activist that one of the things you have to do when you're organizing is make space for individual agency, make space for people who don't easily join. What's interesting is to make spaces where very different desires can meet without agreeing, end quote. Cooperative galleries and group work of various kinds pose the great difficulty of working with, not just containing, differences. a certain control, the assuredness that critical thought and argument rely on. Well, this is simply sliced through, dissolved. By what exactly, it's hard to say. By the group's energies, by counter-arguments and power plays. How did each orchard artist make herself vulnerable, allowing the affective edges of the unreasonable to show in public? This is not what theory does or what definitions or categories do. This is an anti-theory of the cognitive and the affective, the communicating and the non-communicating of a group in and through each other. The second part of my talk narrows in on an example from my work right now. By right now, I mean this is part of an essay I was writing on Election Day, which was published in January, the month of the 46th president's inauguration. In reading this, I can immediately apply one of the principles I believe were among those we tried to work with at Orchard, and I quote R.H. Quaitman again. Giving voice to artists who remain active and relevant outside the embrace of the Markin-driven art establishment is one of Orchard's strengths. It is increasingly important to look at ways artists survive and flourish outside of or in spite of market support, end quote. That is how Quaitman described Orchard's stance in 2005. Her overture to surviving and flourishing as an actuality, as what's real, is quite deliberate. Okay, so the piece you're about to hear was written from my viewing Beverly Buchanan's art in a recent exhibition. Everyday life in Los Angeles with its palpable moments of beautiful differentiation has also been a part of my thinking. In this writing, I try to view from a wide open place to see the work and Buchanan's story outside the exclusions and regulations of difference, while knowing how racism has worked on the work, what effects it has had on her life and her career, as well as what critical environment racism has built. In the place of these dynamics of marginality, I begin to imagine the task of criticism as making an alternative practice out of the work. That is, not making an alternative form of identity out of or with the work. I mean something else by practice, and I think the work shows us this, because I can see the work is already producing many things to render the identities that get made. Black personhood, black artist, artist who is a woman, to render such identities as maybe less than they are or less than we hold them to be, as provisional, as maybe not what we need, as less than what we need, these ideas of selves and others. This self-other binary assumes the political to be predicated on exclusion and regulation, on visibility and non-visibility. Forms of containment and regulation are what these things are. We are told, quote, the presence of the subject is essential for the implementation of political power, end quote. But art gives us other ideas of subjectivity, ideas about how not to be complicit with power, how not to be in compliance with assumed political subjects and their violent splits of the binary of self and other, you and me. This is the divisiveness capitalism wants for us. We know it all too well. I'm showing you Buchanan's cast concrete works from the late 70s. Beverly Buchanan was born in 1940 in North Carolina and created artwork of singular scale, force, and emotion. From her earliest series, for which she responded to the deteriorating urban environments of New York and New Jersey in the 1970s, to her later works, which intertwine with oral history to excavate African-American social life in rural communities of the American Southeast, Buchanan undertook a deep, empirically driven study of architecture and visual art. With her work, the artist asked crucial questions. She attempted to see inside architecture and through it, and to reveal it as something organic and human and reparative. Beverly Buchanan, Ruins and Rituals at the Brooklyn Museum's Elizabeth A. Sackler Center for Feminist Art, the exhibition closed just a few weeks ago, spans Buchanan's earthworks and site-specific sculptures, photographs and drawings, photocopied books and notebooks and paintings and mixed media work. The exhibition is also essentially posthumous, as Buchanan passed away in July 2015 at an early moment in the development of the show. The exhibition raises extreme emotions. Viewing this work leaves me haunted. How can I write with candor about viewing Buchanan's art in a museum today? How can I do so without euphemism, without leaving unspoken the material and lived forms of racism that have authoritatively failed to support and sustain Black avant-garde voices? We have not seen this work, have not told enough stories of artists like Buchanan in museums and in this magazine. The magazine is where this was published, Art Forum. If you recall, this piece appeared in Art Forum in January. Buchanan possessed a fierce independent streak. Her early life coincided with the civil rights movement and its aftermath, and she maintained the course of her work despite receiving bruises at a sit-in when she was a medical technology student. She pursued a bachelor's degree at Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina. And she pursued her work despite being dragged down by life's trials, as when she lacked the money to produce her art or when she was suffering from long-term health problems. She lived with asthma and the side effects of the prednisone she had to take to manage it. And she did it despite, and this Buchanan has said over and over to interviewers, having made the difficult choice to abandon her work as a public health educator and medical technologist in her late 30s to pursue the less stable and socially acceptable path of artist. She had obtained a master's degree in public health from Columbia University in New York in 1969. Alice Walker, a contemporary of Buchanan's, has unflinchingly written about her own creative output, how it was enlarged by life's experiences, the good and the bad. It appears Buchanan's art was enlarged and not crippled by her own. This also goes by another name, resistance. I think of her fortitude and strength in these matters when I imagine her lifting, casting, and moving unreasonably heavy stones or rubble or her concrete sculptures. This is her artist statement from 1978 for Wall Fragments, where she comes up with this title, Frustilla. And I'm interested in how Buchanan uses this piece of writing as a way of circumventing more codified modes of seeing. You can just read along as I continue. In Buchanan's lifetime, the institutions of art and society at large typecast and stereotyped Black artists and artists from the American South. We should be angry then about what didn't happen during her life. The regular public exhibitions, the inclusion of her work in museum collections, catalogs, and books. And while this show, which puts on view nearly 200 objects, photographs, and other materials, may be seen as a corrective, the mere act of telling Buchanan's story does little to alter the structures of power that marginalized her work, or any work in the first place. I feel certain that Buchanan's work did and does resound loudly and clearly, whether it was shown or supported in public or whether it was not. To imagine the work as autonomous, as independent, lets us see it apart from the familiar binary of center and margin. This show, the most comprehensive exhibition of the artist's work to date, was conceived and curated by artist Park MacArthur and curator Jennifer Burris, who developed the show from their research for a book called Beverly Buchanan, 1978 to 1981. MacArthur and Burris are younger than Buchanan by 4 decades, and this not insignificant difference in generational positions is at times apparent in the show. Here are some stills. Burris and Buchanan and an artist named Jason Harada went to Buchanan's 4 of her well-known large-scale public artworks and commissions and created video and sound documents based on their viewing and based on still photography that Buchanan had taken. So this is the one in Macon, Georgia at the Museum of Arts and Sciences. It's called Ruins and Rituals. This one had 2 other elements, something that was hidden in the woods and another piece of it was actually submerged in a nearby river. And then in the marshes, in the Georgia coastal waters is the piece called Ruins and Rituals. So consider this video, June 10 to 19, 2016, a 3-channel video installation that dominates the first gallery of their show. Researched, filmed, and produced by MacArthur and Burris with Jason Harada, the work features shots of 4 of Buchanan's monumental site-specific sculptures in Georgia and Florida. The video combines various takes of a piece in situ with ambient sounds recorded separately in the vicinity of a given shot, and it reproduces a wider range of audio than one would ever encounter in person. The editing and sound in these works is therefore supplemental, kind of keyed to a much more technologically aware or hyper-technologically oriented viewer of today. For Buchanan, by contrast, who didn't herself use a video camera to document these or any of her works, it was vision that was paramount. She gave herself permission to look hard and deeply at the world, an act of empowerment for a Black woman born in a country still under the grip of Jim Crow. Around 100 of the artworks and other materials in the show are densely centered in this second gallery, which features a presentation from Buchanan's personal archives in a series of 7 vitrines. Here we find the work Medicine Woman from 1993, and 7 vitrines displaying a range of archival items, including black and white photographs, invitation cards, artist books, small Xeroxed or printed and bound projects, and copies of Buchanan's artist statements. Her prints and Polaroids remind us how direct observation, note-taking, and on-the-ground research, how vision itself fed her sculptural work. In these carefully selected and sequenced displays, artworks and documentation coalesce with personal archives to conjure an alternate artist-made world. We catch glimpses of Buchanan's rich private life, pictures of supporters and peers and friends and lovers, as well as in the margins for more creative investigations into personal identity. The ongoing act of self-representation in this archive serves as a challenge to the so-called mainstream or the formation of language, biology, history, society, modernism, museum that marginalized Buchanan, and it may be her most important existing work. But herein lies one of the contradictions of the show. I would venture that Ruins and Rituals relies too heavily on such materials at the expense of a fuller presentation of Buchanan's sculptural production. In the first gallery, for example, a single work on paper stands in for all the works from the series Black Walls of 71 or City Walls of 1976, and there's cast concrete experiments from when she was in New York to 77 and the years that she relocated down to Georgia, first Macon and then Atlanta in the late 70s and early 80s. What would have been observed and felt had we seen these works with more examples? Why the reticence to select works from key periods in cases where artworks have survived or are portable and offer them up for firsthand experience? The show's final gallery focuses on Buchanan's series Shack Stories, made between 1986 and 2015, and derived from close observation and extensive research. These small-scale sculptures of shotgun houses underscore Buchanan's passion for vernacular hand-built dwellings and their inhabitants, and the storytelling that unites the two. Assembled from everyday materials such as pine, tar, clay, and tin, they revealed a nuanced sense of shape and color, thrift and humor. We find humanist personification and anthropomorphism dark with the history of slavery and the economic system that was left in its wake. They disinter experience and memory. This work you're seeing is called Out of Control from 1991, and Buchanan is in the backyard of her house in Athens, Georgia, and she's burning some of her wood shacks. The artist related these performances with burnings of her own shacks to the racial violence she experienced as a student protester in Greensboro, North Carolina in the early 60s. In 1990, after Buchanan installed a solo exhibition at Bernice Steinbaum Gallery in New York, an interviewer for National Public Radio pitched her questions. During their conversation, Buchanan refused to make a distinction between artists who are folk artists and artists who are not, speaking instead of folk artists as her peers. "Artists make art because they have to," she said, quote, "it's almost a compulsive thing," end quote. With this statement in mind, I take from seeing Buchanan's work in the exhibition, Ruins and Rituals, that the need to create is political and personal. Existing beyond race or class, the creative act becomes a model of the social. In closing the exchange, the artist tells the interviewer, "We're all here." Okay, here's my last slide. Closing. It's Monday, March 13th, morning time. I see that I have an email from Christian Philip Muller, who you may recall is an Orchard member. He has sent a folder of photographs, and this one in particular takes my breath away. This is Christian's photograph of a piece by artist Yuji Agamatsu. It captures the collected materials of Agamatsu's piece where it lives now, on the windowsill of a set of rooms where Miguel Abreu Gallery is housed, on Eldred Street in New York's Lower East Side. This building is just a short walk from the storefront Orchard once occupied and then vacated in May 2008. Christian tells me this work is placed in the gallery where Agamatsu's exhibition Self-Portrait is, but that this one remains private, this work. This one is not for sale. At the top of the press release of the gallery is a quote by Agamatsu. "What can be done? We must risk mortality and decay." I want to write in a direct way about Buchanan's work and about racism and other social conditions without euphemism and without the cover and weak protection of specialist frameworks and language. I want to embark on a radically self-aware looking and listening with its wrenching degree of self-scrutiny, with its creation and loss. In the simplest impulses of these acts of pointing to something unseen or lost, or witnessing the critical environment that was built for Buchanan, knowing it's not the one that we want, we feel the passing of time, as with the film stop. To repeat a quote you heard earlier in this talk, "When the towers fell, I changed my focus. I'm not the only one." That's what Forti said about 9/11. Orchard was an imperfect, frugal, and humble response to this crisis of the mid-2000s. It took resilience to try at something like Orchard, to shift our focus from self to other and outward, to other kinds of political subjects, to care, to self-care. I believe that what we can now use of Orchard is to fashion a working model of this kind of co-human work, with its independence and its ethic of disagreement, and then just move on quickly to our own time. What do artists own? I am asking about all forms of possession and dispossession, not just acquisitional capitalist forms of possession, for I see Agamatsu's acts as acts against preservation and of an alternative kind of self-importance. Oh, you won't let me take off the last slide. Anyway, that's the end. Terry, we're going to take questions, right?
I'll get us started then, because I'm wondering, I know what some of the artists from Orchard are now doing, but I wonder, without doing another lecture, which that would involve, if you could talk a little bit about maybe what some of them are doing and how, I mean, this has to, I know it's affected your work and the way you look at art and think about the act of making art. Can you maybe even highlight one or two and talk about what they're doing now and how maybe that grew out of Orchard or Orchard was just part of it?
Let's see. It's a really good question. It's hard to answer that briefly.
Right.
I mean, I think what's the first thing that I can think to say is that once you stop working as a group, you kind of revert back to working the way you did before as an individual.
Is that right?
And it's so very, very different. And the two are just very different. So, I mean, that's what I think of the most. Is, I mean, we all have a memory of working together and we're in touch and following what each other is doing. But that's what's most striking to me is that it's kind of an aberration from how we all work to work together. It's something that you have to construct. It's actually very artificial. It's not really what the world wants you to do. Mm-hmm. The world wants you to kind of work under one name and make things very clear and kind of allow what you're doing to be like clearly legible or something. And so what to me it seems like very surprising that we actually managed to work all together for 3 years and sort of, we never stopped working as individuals while we were doing the group work, but I can understand how hard that is actually now. Maybe I was young enough that I didn't even realize how hard it was. Yeah. Sometimes when you go into something blindly, it's a little bit better. So now I realize how rare it is. But I can give you one example. The print that we just made, the inkjet print of R.H. Quaitman, which actually contains a kind of catalog of all the programs and exhibitions and works that we showed or produced at Orchard, and a lot of the fiscal responsibilities, and it's laid out like a spreadsheet, and then it's a print on paper, and Quaitman added her optical effects of black and white bars and stripes. When I had the experience of finishing that work, and I worked with a curator from Portland, Robert Snowden, he's now in New York, and we sort of curated Rebecca, I found myself in Miguel Abreu Gallery, and Miguel is her dealer, and I found myself in conversations with him about Quaitman's work, and what surprised me was that in talking about this print, he had to talk about Orchard, and he had to talk about the time when we all worked together, and it was something that he knows very well, but he didn't normally absorb in the way that he would talk about the painting projects and the exhibitions and site-specific work that she's produced after. So it was very striking to hear the conversation of everybody working together kind of infect and surround the conversation of her paintings. Mm-hmm. And then he went and hung the print in a group exhibition, sort of in the same room and near one of her paintings. So that felt very strong to me and interesting to hear that, like, how difficult it was and maybe not natural to put the two practices together, the group practice and her other practice that existed before and that continued after Orchard, but it felt really nice to have a way of talking about those two ways of working together.
Well, I was reading today an interview with Andrea Fraser, and it was from, I don't know, a few months ago, and she was talking about how she's now focusing on, and probably for a time now, has been focusing on psychoanalysis.
Yes, in group relations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't help but think about that when I was watching her piece for Orchard.
It's very connected, actually.
I don't
That's
want
true.
To
Thank
cut
you for
into
that.
Anybody else wanting to ask, so you're going to need to yell out if you want to ask a question. Okay, good, Mark. Yeah, I think we do. I can't remember why, if it's for the podcast.
It's probably for the podcast.
I'm just curious. The move from Orchard to Irvine is quite a move, and I wondered how it's affected your practice in what ways, or has it?
It has affected my practice. I mean, an obvious, maybe overly simple thing to say is that the geographical distance actually allowed me to process the experience of Orchard in a different way, like actually leaving New York, locating myself in a different place in this country. And I sat for 4 or 5 years before really actively reflecting on Orchard and picking up the archive and working on this book project that I... I'm pretty close to finishing now, and I think the distance really helped. I'm very connected to New York. I still do a lot of work there, and I travel 5 or 6 times a year there, but I think it very much helped. What else? I think I didn't realize to the extent that I had probably been educated in kind of East Coast canon of modernist and postmodern and neo-avant-garde and experimental art, and I had started learning about some of these practices when I was in New York, and I heard about some of them. And obviously there are some West Coast artists that I followed, but that was something that I took up right away. Simone Fortier, the dancer who you heard me quoting, Barbara T. Smith, Michael Asher, who we had actually worked with at Orchard, Charles Gaines, many, many artists who had emerged in the 60s and 70s. I felt excited living in a different city to be able to meet with those artists and be in their studios and work with their archives and kind of think about my experience in New York, which had been about 20 years from being a student to my first teaching job at Bard College, to like put that in a different perspective, to look at that from the West Coast. And I was very grateful. I'm very grateful that I had that opportunity. It changed how I think about how that history of post-war and 21st century kind of gets narrated. Absolutely.
Would you mind? Oh, good. Never mind. I'll hold that.
I'm curious about how, and you referred to the archive, if you pulled together all the materials after you left Orchard, or if you all have bits and pieces of the archive to avoid one central narrative, for example.
It's both. That central narrative could not really be possible because although we worked as a group, we always spoke in our own voice. So we wrote things alone or with two or three other people, and we worked on many of the exhibitions in smaller groups, and we never stopped speaking in our individual voice. So the archive is exactly as you described. Pieces of it are held by each member. And we worked, after Orchard closed over 2008 to early 2010, to centralize a certain portion of it. A lot of the photographs of installations, the checklists of exhibitions, kind of the basic material, so that we could all use it and have access to it, and so that a project like this could start to have its development. And it's not, there's nothing formal about it. We centralized most of that material that we centralized is digital, and we have like a stable web host for it with enough memory and things like that, but we haven't actually gone through the type of procedures that you need to construct an archive and create the finding aids and really organize it and describe it to make it usable by other people and available in the public way. We haven't really thought about that. We don't have any plans. It seems like a lot just to work with the material enough to come up with this one book project. Other members speak about Orchard and lecture on it. I certainly imagine other projects will come out of the material. So far this is a first.
Just because I'm next door. I had a question about the site of Orchard in terms of New York City, and I'm sure you've thought about this and talked about this ad nauseum, so this is really blunt, boring question, but I think in terms of New York City, it might speak to larger things about Orchard, but wondering how you feel, if you could postulate how a project like this would have been read in something, let's say, like Chelsea or Uptown or even Brooklyn or Los Angeles, for instance, like how critical the Lower East Side was.
Well, we thought of ourselves as being very critical of Chelsea as a gallery district kind of. We had all been in New York since the mid-'80s or the late-'80s. I got there in 86 to go to Columbia College as an undergraduate. And we had seen already the Lower East Side and the East Village and then Soho, and Chelsea emerged in the mid-90s. So we very much felt that we were a corrective and a reaction to Chelsea being like an art neighborhood or an art district that was very driven by galleries and their architectural needs and their needs to create those spaces that were very different from the spaces where artists lived and worked. Soho as a loft district and light manufacturing place had always been about those galleries open up and performance spaces like opening up very much intimately near where art was being produced. I mean, of course, by the early 2000s, artists were living and working in Brooklyn and things were getting very decentralized already. That's only become more and more the case. We were in the part of the Lower East Side that's below Delancey Street, for those of you who know New York, and, a neighborhood known for its history of Jewish immigrants, also waves of Chinese immigration overlapping, areas that have been called Chinatown, a vast, actually complex neighborhood, but working class and poor, fairly low income, median income neighborhood, many rent-controlled apartment buildings and things like that, that kind of covers this whole swath on the, by the East River. And, that was just, it really wasn't being gentrified. We were one of the first things there. The Lower East Side around Houston Street was, what it is now, a place for entertainment and bars and restaurants. And the zoning laws that, we did an exhibition that took this up directly, but by the last year and a half of Orchard, the city was undergoing a process to change all of the zoning laws, which is what would allow, laws that had been in place since 1965, which is what, to oversimplify it, allowed the construction of a lot of these high-rise loft towers and apartment buildings and a lot of the new hotel construction that you see. So our project was existing at the time that these really fundamental changes were going on in the neighborhood. And we had relationships with people who were involved in, you know, that political organizing about that discussion. And this was also a moment of a lot of political organizing on the part of radical queer groups and transgender groups. And there's a project called the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, which has been really important to fight for rights for transgender people, encompassing everything, access to jobs, healthcare, housing, conflicts they were having with landlords, all kinds of ways that they were being discriminated against. And Orchard hosted benefit auction and supported that group. So we tried in our way to jump into the conversations that were happening in the neighborhood, but of course these forces are larger than us, and we had to manage the sense that we were part of a change in the neighborhood that was happening, and that our galleries were, you know, a vehicle in that change. I think we felt that we weren't a negative force on our own block and in our own building because we knew our landlord very intimately, and we spoke with her, and we understood what the history of, like, what rents she had been charging, and we chose her because she was an individual who wasn't looking to change her rental policy. She wasn't looking to rent to, you know, kind of white people looking for lower rents, right, the kind of waves that happen in a neighborhood. She was very, very conscious. She inherited the building that had been built by the Astors, and she had inherited it from her parents, and she had a very deeply rooted, very organic relationship to that neighborhood. She understood its history very intimately, so she thought long and hard before she rented to us, and we had like a very, we learned a lot from that conversation with her, from her observations about what was the change that was going on in the neighborhood, and from her strength, I guess, in having her own ethics and trying to resist or slow down that change in the ways that we felt she was doing. So that was one of the things that had the biggest impact on us. Of course, in that building, we were just that building. We couldn't, other people were thinking differently. Other landlords were interested in making more profit than that. But it was something we had to take responsibility for, housing our project there for sure.
I really like that you were able to talk about that, because I think that gave a lot of insight into who and why Orchard was, and I appreciate that. Maybe we could just close with you talking just for a minute about the way you opened, talking about the two instructions you gave us and how to approach this lecture and what we were going to see and experience.
Yeah, trying to foreground this idea of experience itself and this idea of giving ourselves permission to think and absorb things without kind of rushing to this space, this overly intellectualized space. Of course, I'm an intellectual. I love intellectual spaces. But rushing to this sense to try to put a position on an artwork into words, to move so quickly from experiencing something into language and the things that can happen to fix meaning and to overly narrate things and to use theory or critique, you know, too strongly, sometimes violently, and to try to ask ourselves, you know, why we work in that way or why we do this. I think that was part of the theoretical and historical part of Orchard as a project, was to, you know, to fight orthodoxy and academicization and to fight the way that things get ossified and fixed over time. Contemporary art is the space that, well, we struggle with those things. On the other hand, we would like to think that artists of all ages can put new ideas and new thoughts and new objects and new ways of seeing into the situation, and that it actually takes us a long time to hear those things and think about what they are. And reception unfolds over time, and it's a debate that includes a lot of difference and a lack of consensus. So I think also sometimes we try too hard to agree on things or to define things and to categorize things, and it doesn't help us to understand this thing that I want to call differentiation, you know, this what I think the value of being with an artwork, thinking with an artwork, in having that as a form of knowledge and experience, right, that's different from other forms of knowledge. So, and differentiation, of course, also goes really deeply to these questions of identity that are very human, not just identity in the cultural and social and biological way, but like we understand the limits of ourself, our body, ourself, when we're confronted with an artwork. I mean, identity has to do with the artwork and the viewer and social and cultural things and the whole viewing situation. It's a place where we can reflect on these questions that are pretty deep human questions.
Seems like a really positive
thing. Thank you for coming.